Okay, so we'll start. Today is August 25th, 2012. Okay, let me start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Let's see where we are. Okay, we've been studying now the sutta number 77 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Maha Sakaludayi Sutta. This is the longer discourse to Sakaludayi. Okay, and so we've been going through the reasons why the Buddha's disciples respect, venerate him, and live in dependence on him. That's the main theme of the sutta. And the fifth way that we came to of these five ways in which they respect him is called, in general, the way to develop wholesome states, wholesome qualities. And we went through the seven sections on the 37 aids to enlightenment, the Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, and then we come to a variety of additional practices. I did last week the eight Vimokas, the eight liberations, which, as I explained last week, are not states of ultimate or final liberation, but they are states of deep or deepening samadhi or concentration, in which the mind is liberated from certain obstacles to those higher states those higher attainments. Okay, now we come to a group or a set called the eight. Here it's translated the eight bases for transcendence. I'll put the Pali word on the board. I'm not so sure that I like the translation basis for transcendence with this term, because that seems always to suggest some state of deep, like nirvanic realization. But again, these attainments are not states like of transcendence in that sense. but rather they are states of, again, they're levels or states of samadhi, most of them are, which involve the overcoming of certain obstacles. And by overcoming the obstacles, then one is enabled to enter into these states of deep samadhi, deep concentration. Somebody last week asked about the meaning of ayatana. So we see the way the word ayatana is used in various contexts. In the Eight Liberations, we have ayatana used for the four formless meditations, the base of the boundless space, base of boundless consciousness, base of nothingness, base of neither perception nor non-perception. And here again we have the word ayatana used to designate a certain stage or level of meditation. And if we look at the eight bases for transcendence, this is my own hypothesis, it seems to me that they are a finer differentiation of the first three liberations. If we just take a quick look at the eight liberations, just the first three. The first is, this is on page 638, possessed of material form, one sees forms. In Pali, this is rupi, which means having form. Like something made out of matter is called rupi, having form. One sees forms. Rupani pasati. Then not perceiving forms internally, one sees forms externally. And then one is resolved only upon the beautiful. So those are the first three liberations. Okay, bearing those in mind, now we go to the eight transcendences. So the Buddha begins the passage by saying, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the eight bases for transcendence. Now I would render this the bases for overcoming things. Okay, so now the first one, perceiving form internally, one sees forms externally, limited, fair and ugly, or beautiful and not beautiful. And then by transcending them, one perceives thus, I know, I see. This is the first base for transcendence. Okay, now regarding the eight bases for transcendence, I have to say the same thing that I said last week for the eight liberations. Like within the ongoing Theravada tradition, you know, practitioners, at least those I've known, spoken to, don't often speak in terms of the eight liberations or the eight bases for transcendence. Even within the commentarial works like Visuddhimagga, these ways of grouping the meditative attainments have almost fallen into the background, and they've been supplanted by the scheme of either the eight attainments, which means the four jhanas and the four formless attainments, or sometimes the nine attainments, adding the attainment of cessation. So that's become the dominant way of classifying meditative states. And since that system of the four jhanas and the four formless meditations is, in a way, it's more logical, it's more systematic, clearer than the eight liberations and the eight bases for transcendence, these others have, you know, receded somewhat into the background. So the commentaries, they have to explain them because they come in the text. But one doesn't find them mentioned very often thereafter in works, in the commentarial works, or in works based on the commentaries. Okay, so when I explain them, I'm relying here on the commentary. But it seems that the commentary is received the scholastic way of explaining them, and we can't be 100% certain that this is the way that they were actually practiced. Okay, so when it comes to this expression, perceiving form internally, this means that one picks up an initial object of concentration from some form internal to the body. So one takes, for example, the commentary will explain, if one is going to be focusing on the blue kasina, one takes the color of the hair, because I guess the Indians and would have very dark black hair, so that it shines in the sun, it seems almost like bluish black. Or for the blue kasina, one could take it from something internally. If somebody has blue eyes, you could pick up the blue of the eyes. For the yellow, to focus on yellow, one could take, it could be the color of the skin, if the skin is a bit yellowish. Pick up white, one could take the whites of the eyes. For red, one could take the color of the blood. So one starts off by picking up an internal colored object, and then one starts off by focusing upon that colored object till one gets a clear image of it, mental image. Then one takes up external form material objects that have a particular color, and then one perceives those as the basis of concentration. So for the easiest example would be flowers, yellow, blue, white, red flowers, or pieces of cloth, and so on. And then one sees those objects. But in this initial stage, one is only able to visualize the object in the meditative state as limited, occupying a limited space. And the forms might have the imperfections of the original object. You know, so there's not, say, the hairs are not a perfect blue, or the eye is not a perfect blue, or the blood not a perfect red, color of the skin not a perfect yellow. So it's fair and ugly. Some of the forms will be pretty, some will be defective, deformed. But this is in an initial stage, and so one starts off in this way, perceiving the forms in the state of meditative concentration. One becomes absorbed in them. Okay, and then the text says, by transcending them, one perceives, thus I know, I see. The way the commentary explains this, well, the commentary explains this to mean that one emerges from that meditative state, and then one reflects back upon it, and one knows that one has seen in this way, one has known the object in this way. I'm not so sure that this passage has to be understood in this way. It could be, this would be an alternative interpretation, that one uses the object as a basis for concentration, okay, and then one overcomes the object of concentration, and then one gains insight to, it could be into one of the three characteristics, impermanence, suffering, non-self, based upon the original object. And in this way, one comes to the conclusion, I know, I see. So that's another way to interpret this. Okay, now we come to the second basis for transcendence. This is almost the same as the first, except with one significant difference. Okay, perceiving form internally, one sees forms externally. Again, the initial procedure is the same, Okay, but now the forms are immeasurable, upamanang, measureless, boundless, fair, but they're still fair and ugly, and by transcending them one perceives thus, I know, I see. Okay, so according to the commentarial way of interpretation, what this means, okay, in the first basis, one starts off with that samadhi based on a form, but the form, because one is picking it up from some kind of object, an object that's actually been perceived with the eyes, it's limited in dimensions. But once one gains samadhi or concentration based upon that limited object, one can then start expanding the object, increasing the object, so that it will spread out from a limited region till it seems to spread out, covering all of boundless space. For example, if one is inwardly perceiving, say, a red form, it might seem in the mind's eye to be maybe about 6 inches in diameter. But then one can start expanding the size of that circle. So it will go from as if it were 6 inches, going to 9 inches, 12 inches, 2 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet, 6 feet. And then I guess once you go beyond 6 feet, it seems like 12 feet. Thereafter it can seem as though it's covering boundless space. And so it becomes immeasurable. Okay, so that's the second base for transcendence. Okay, then the third base. Okay, not perceiving form internally, one perceives forms externally. It seems in this case, one doesn't pick up the initial object from something internal to the body, but one begins straight off with taking an external form as the initial object. Or it could be, this is another way to understand this, that instead of picking up the initial form from the body and then developing an inward visualization of forms, as though the forms were external, one doesn't have to rely upon the form taking up some concrete material form as the object, but one can, because one has gained experience with this meditation, one can immediately sit down, cross the legs, and visualize a form without having to start off from a concrete, an actual concrete instance of form. So if I want to visualize a blue form, I don't have to start off with either a blue of the eyes or even a blue flower, but I just sit down, cross the legs, and conjure up the image of a blue form, and there it is before my mental vision. Okay, so not perceiving forms internally, one sees forms externally, but here the forms are still limited, fair and ugly, by transcending them one perceives thus I know and see. This is the third base for transcendence. Okay, the fourth, again, is the same, not perceiving forms internally, one sees forms externally, but now they are immeasurable, fair and ugly, and by transcending them one perceives thus I know, I see. So you could see that these four bases for transcendence seem to be very similar, they seem to be variations on the first two liberations, possessed of material form, that would correspond to the case of perceiving form internally, then one sees forms, that seems to correspond to one sees forms externally. Okay, so that seems to cover the first base of the first liberation seems to cover the first two bases for transcendence, and then the second liberation seems to cover the first liberation seems to cover the first two bases for transcendence. The second liberation, not perceiving form internally, one sees forms externally, seems to cover the third and fourth bases for transcendence, or to correspond to them. Okay, now it seems to me that the next four bases for transcendence are elaborations of the third liberation. The third liberation is one is resolved only upon the beautiful. And the commentary explains this is that one develops the samadhi or concentration based upon beautiful kasina objects. I'm going to come to the kasinas in a moment. But the kasina is basically a disc used as an object of concentration. Okay, so in this case, not perceiving form internally, one sees forms externally, and now comes a description of those forms. Blue, of blue color, blue appearance, with a blue luminosity or a blue radiance. Okay, so you'll see that the fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth bases for transcendence, the description is exactly the same except for the color that's involved. So the last four bases for transcendence are really, in a way, just one base for transcendence, which is simply differentiated according to different colors, four different colors. So this seems to correspond to one is resolved only upon the beautiful. So if the beautiful means the beautiful colors, then all you do is divide those colors up to distinguish those colors as blue, yellow, red, and white, and then you have the fifth to eighth bases for transcendence. Okay, so here one is in the first of these, one is perceiving blue. Then this is illustrated by a flax flower. Has anybody seen a flax flower? They must grow in America, I think, because we have flax oil here. Flax, people use flax seeds. But I don't think I've ever seen the color. I don't think I've ever seen the flower. Nobody else has?
I thought it was yellow.
Excuse me?
I thought it was yellow.
Maybe in America they're yellow, but perhaps in India they're blue. Okay, so anyway, a flax flower, which is blue, of blue color, blue in appearance, with blue luminosity, or just like Benares cloth. Benares, in ancient times, even today, is very famous for the quality of its cloth. Smoothened on both sides, is blue, of blue color, blue in appearance, with blue, it's not really luminous like phosphorescent, but I guess this is just another word for color. So too, again, one, not perceiving form internally, one sees forms externally, that's a mental vision, which are blue, with a blue radiance and so forth. Then one transcends this and one knows, I know, I see. Okay, the sixth base for liberate for transcendence, exactly the same except that the forms are yellow and the simile is given of something called the Kanikara flower. Again, I don't know. There must be a flower like rose in India. Is there something like this in Sri Lanka? Does the name sound familiar? Sometimes the singular words are derived from the Pali or Sanskrit words. Kanikar flower, nothing like that. Okay, we don't know exactly what it is, but obviously it's of a yellow color. Okay, that's the sixth base for transcendence. The seventh base for transcendence is the red forms with a red color. And then these are compared to the hibiscus flower. Anybody know a hibiscus flower what is? Do you know, Judy? Is it
It's a big red flower.
Big red flower. Maybe we can take the red rose. The rose is really pinkish, not really a pure red. Is there any really bright red, pure red flower? Other flower that grows in America? Poppy. Poppies grow in America.
Geranium.
What?
Geranium.
You know, growing up in Brooklyn.
That's red in the bouquet.
Is it a real flower? Okay.
It's my color.
Okay. Anyway, it's red, yeah. Okay, so that is the seventh base of overcoming or transcendence. Then the eighth is not perceiving form internally. One sees forms externally, white, of white color, white appearance, white luminosity. Okay, here the simile is not given of a flower, but what is called, in Pali, is called the osada taraka, which literally means the medicine star. But in English, I think we translated it as the morning star. It actually is referring, in reality, it's the planet Venus, which appears very early in the morning. Usually it seems to be the brightest star in the sky, though it's not a star. Very bright, relatively large. And again, it's a very white color. So just like the morning star, which is white, of white color, white in appearance, with white luminosity, or just like Benares cloth, which is white, white in appearance, and so on, so he sees forms externally with a white appearance, white color, white luminosity. And by transcending them, one perceives thus, I know, I see. Okay, so those are the eight bases for transcendence. Now, it seems to me that the eight bases for liberation, the eight liberations and the eight bases for transcendence would have been easier to understand if the 10 kasinas were placed first before them. And perhaps in the original presentation, perhaps the 10 kasinas came first. Because the kasinas are really the foundation or substance of a number of the liberations and basis for transcendence. Okay, the kasina is usually it's a circular object which is used as a basis for contemplation, for gaining samadhi, concentration. I don't have personal experience with the kasinas, but I know that they're used in Sri Lanka in some of the meditation centers, and I know monks who have practiced them. So they are part of contemporary practice. And the kasinas are given a lot of explanation in the Visuddhimagga, which actually takes the earth kasina as its basis for explaining the whole system of the jhanas. Okay, so the kasina, initially, it's a physical object that's used as a basis for concentration. And so we have four kasinas, which represent the four physical elements, and four colored kasinas. Those are the main kasinas that are used. So the earth kasina will be, initially, it's a circular disc. One might take a strip of metal or a strip of wood and make a kind of container or a rim. See if I could draw this three-dimensional. These things will be like supports to hold up the object. So this is used to make like a rim. And so there might be some space, maybe about an inch of space here. So it's about an inch of depth, you could call it. And then the inner part of the kasina will be filled with clay or with mud. Smooth it over till it's as smooth as one can make it. And then one allows the clay or the mud to dry. And then the meditator will put it a certain distance away from himself, maybe supported by a chair so that its meditator will be sitting maybe on a seat, meditation seat here. And that kasina disc will be supported by the chair. If he's sitting on the floor, he might put it up against the wall so he gets a good representation, visual representation of that colored disc. And then he'll begin by focusing the mind simply on this object as representing earth, earth. So he'll just be focusing the mind over and over on the kasina object, call it, thinking to himself, earth, 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 just to get the mental impression of the kasina. Sometimes he'll open the eyes and look at the actual object and close the eyes and just try to represent the object through internal visualization. Again, opening, closing, opening, closing. And he has to do this repeatedly until he can get an inner impression of the earth object, of the earth kasina, as vivid, as clear, as he would be able to perceive it if his eyes were open. Then at that point, he can put aside the physical earth kasina, and now he's working with the mental representation of that earth kasina. So now we could call the internal representation becomes the earth kasina. And then he keeps on meditating on that inward visualized object over and over. If it starts to fade out, he might have to go back and use the physical object for some time. But he has to keep on practicing until there emerges from that mentally visualized image of the earth kasina, what is called the nimitta, in this case the patibhaga nimitta. This is what's translated sometimes as the sign, or now I would use the mark. It's not a consciously constructed object, not a consciously constructed mental representation, but when it starts off, what passes from the actual physical object to the inner mental representation, then out of the mental representation there emerges almost like spontaneously an inwardly visualized image of the earth kasina, which is bright, very, very pure, and it seems almost to have maybe put it in quotation marks, a life of its own. It's not that it doesn't seem to be something that one is consciously creating, consciously constructing or conjuring through effort. Yeah, Richard.
Yeah, when one does that, is that putting oneself in the first basis for transcendence, or the second, or a later one? Because the later ones just talk about not perceiving form internally, only externally. There's the first.
Yeah, I think the way the commentaries explain perceiving form internally, they explain that you pick up the form, the impression of that particular form one is working with from the physical body. You know, so one picks up, as I explained, the image of, say, red from the color of the blood, the image of blue from the color of the hair, the image of white, maybe from the color of the teeth, so if somebody has bright white teeth, or the whites of the eyes, or the impression of blue, yellow, red.
So the internal image is not the internal image of the casino itself?
No. The image of the casino, I think, I'm using the word internally in a somewhat different sense from the text. I'm using internally in the more normal sense in which we use it in English, that it's an internally visualized object and that one is not looking at anything external, you know, with one's actual eyes. I'm using so internal in the sense of mentally visualized, whereas in the text, the way the commentary explains the word perceiving form internally means that one picks up the impression of the form that one is using as the basis for concentration from one's own body, from one's own from the physical body of a person.
But why does that count as internal instead of external?
Yeah, as I said, this is the way the commentary explains it, and you know, because the living tradition of practice based on these sutta descriptions has, you know, possibly fallen into obscurity. It's no longer been maintained.
Yeah.
So perhaps the commentary isn't explaining it according to the original intention. So I just have to say that these eight bases for transcendence are a bit obscure. That's why I didn't ask, are there any questions about them? Because, just like you asked the question now, all I could do is say, this is what the commentary says, but, or sometimes this is the way I would interpret it, but I don't really know for sure. Okay, so, based upon that mentally visualized image, or whatever, there emerges this sort of bright counterpart to it, which is called, it's a term that doesn't come in the suttas, but it comes in the commentaries. The word used, sometimes it's simply nimitta, or more precisely, it's the patibhaga nimitta, the counterpart. And sometimes a distinction is made of two kinds of nimitta. The mental image that arises simply as a reflex of the original object, you know, when one is looking at it, closing the eyes, looking, closing the eyes, and then when one reaches the point where one could see the object as clearly with the eyes closed, as one can see the actual object with the eyes open, that is called the ukaha nimitta, which means the learning sign, or literally it's the taken up sign, the sign that the mind takes up based on the original material object. But the other nimitta, the patipaga nimitta, which is what we usually refer to as simply as the nimitta, that is, literally, it's the counterpart sign. It's the image of the object that emerges from the learning sign. It's sort of bright, very pure, luminous, and seeming to be independent of one's own volitional attempts to construct an object. It seems to just arise spontaneously. It's compared, the difference between the two signs, the Visuddhimagga compares the ugaha nimitta, the learning sign, is like looking at the full moon on the cloudy night. So there's a layer of clouds, not thick clouds, but thin clouds, that's obscuring the moonlight. So one doesn't see the moon very clearly. But one knows the moon is there, but as the clouds drift by, the image of the moon is partly obscured and distorted by the clouds. But then, if a strong wind comes and blows away all of the clouds, then the sky becomes clear, and then the full moon stands out bright, radiant, beautiful. That is like the patipaga nimitta, the counterpart sign emerging from the learning sign. And this is, then becomes known as the earth kasina, the nimitta, or the sign of the earth kasina. And all of the signs will have the appearance of that same color as the earth. It'll give the impression of earthness. But there's a distinction in degrees of intensity.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
There is an enormous amount of moon imagery and reflected moon imagery in Japanese haiku.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know whether that is, whether the that's the patipaka nimitta that's really, you know, that is being alluded to? And is this kasina, this construction of kasina customs, you know, is that also used in Japan?
I don't think it's particularly emphasized in, say, the Zen tradition of meditation.
Okay.
And I don't, I mean, of course, the moon would just be, particularly in the Asian or traditional cultures where you spend a lot of time outside, and so on, it's very sensitive, and we don't have, in traditional cultures, you know, the bright lights from industrial, from electricity to obscure, and we don't have industrial waste to obscure the sky. So everything is, one has very, very clear impressions of different astronomical objects during the day, and since one is spending a fair amount of time outside, one is very sensitive to the changes of the moon, the sun, and so on. Yeah. So it's just natural that moon imagery would play a very prominent role, I would say, in all types of traditional poetry. And if somebody can do a search through if you get a collection of the Shakespeare sonnets, the sonnets of Shakespeare, and do a search for the word moon. Look through the poetry of, I'm sure in Indian poetry too, even romantic poetry, you get images of the moon. Okay, so of the four kasinas representing the material objects, the one that's most often used in some monasteries in Sri Lanka is the earth kasina. And though I explain the kasinas, one warning that I have to give, it's a warning that I heard, that one shouldn't practice the kasina meditations unless one is doing it under the guidance of a skilled teacher who is experienced in those meditations. Of course, what happens is that when one is visualizing an object, there's a tendency for the mind in the preliminary stages to start projecting perceptual distortions or delusions onto the object. And so I've heard of, some monks project over time very beautiful and attractive, seductive dancing girls, or very beautiful girls, and then they become filled with, they've gone mad, sort of obsessed with the image of the beautiful, beautiful girls. Other people project frightening, demonic images onto the casino, and then they become always fearful and terrified and afraid that they're being pursued, especially when you're living in a monastery, as in Sri Lanka, not with many monks in one building, but it's spread out over a hill with little cottages, little huts. None of them are in hearing range of the other, and so at night you go to your hut, nobody else around, in the dark of the forest. And then if you get these distorted, deluding casino images, then you're seeing faces staring at you from the darkness. You know, the vampires or beasts, wild beasts, or demons, or zombies coming after to get you. Anybody see the movie The Night of the Living Dead from the 1960s? Okay, so to do the water casino, one would take a bowl of clear water and put it out and use that as the initial casino object. The fire and air casinos, I have to say, a bit strange. And I don't know people who have actually used them. But I guess for the fire casino, the way I've heard it described, like in the Visuddhimagga, you would have an actual fire burning, and then one puts in front of it, like it would have to be some distance, so that a wooden board, sufficiently distant so that the board doesn't catch fire. And one has cut a hole in the board so that through the hole one can see the fire. So as one is looking at the fire burning through the wooden board, you will be directing the mind on the impression, fire, fire, fire. But it seems that to succeed with the fire casino, one would have had to have some initial success with the earth casino or the water casino, because the fire, after a certain time, it will start to go down. So if you're planning to do like an hour's meditation and you light the fire, maybe initially the fire, you get a strong fire burning for the first 10 or 15 minutes, but then after the fire burns its supply of wood, then it goes down. If you're not a gifted meditator, able to pick up the sign of fire within that 10-minute period, then you have to start building another fire or refreshing the existing fire, and you lose the consistency of concentration. Then the air casino, I just have to put a question mark over. It's mentioned, but how to practice it, I don't know. Marcy, do you have a question?
What would the inner sign be
for
fire?
Okay, just take the microphone so that other people. What would be the internal sign? It would be like the visualized impression of, it would seem to really turn into almost like a color casino. Of course, one would be picking up the color of the fire. And it said that, especially for the Patibhagani Mitta, for it to be perfect, there shouldn't be motion within the sign. So a fire is like it's always moving, always changing. So if one has that if one has that in one's inner mental visualization, it couldn't be called the Patibhagani Mitta. maybe it would be almost like a photograph. You know, if you have a photograph of a fire, it's not moving in the photograph, but you have the impression of a fire, which is quite distinct from the colors that are making up the fire. That's all I can say. Yeah, so, but within Sri Lanka, after the earth casino, the other casinos that are used most often would be the colored casinos. And so here we have blue, yellow, red, and white casino. One could make the covering of the casino to be a piece of wood which is cut in a circle, and then one simply paints that piece, that round piece of wood, paints it whatever color one wants to use, a deep blue, a deep yellow, very pure white, a very deep red, and then one focuses upon the object. It could be blue, you know, if one takes the blue casino, just focusing on blue, 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 blue. Or if it's the yellow casino, yellow, 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 whichever color one chooses. And the object of this is simply to focus the mind, to collect the mind. It's not, doesn't involve in any way insight or wisdom. But here one is developing the casino in order to build up the power of samadhi, the power of concentration. And so for some meditators, the casinos will be very congenial objects. I found generally, in the cases that I've come to know, it seems to work fairly well with Sri Lankan forest monks who have been living a fairly simple life, maybe because they're able to hone the mind in very quickly and effectively, very quickly and effectively upon that very simple object. I've heard from Westerners who have tried to practice the casino meditations, too often the mind gets sort of troubled by distracting thoughts, by streams of thoughts coming up. I do know some meditators who have worked with, Westerners who have worked with casinos over a long time. But it's said to be quite, even though it seems very simple, but it's because it's simple, it's quite a difficult object to practice. So something like the in and out breathing, since there's change taking place in the breath, and there's a difference between the in-breath and the out-breath, so it has enough differentiation to give to challenge one with something to follow, whereas with the blue circle sitting there, you know, sitting there against the wall when you're sitting on your seat, this blue, blue, blue. For this, I need a PhD in philosophy. Blue, blue, blue. You know, it seems like you start questioning what you're doing, why you're doing it. Am I going to be doing this for the next, you know, 3 or 4 years? Just the only break will be mealtimes and sleep. The rest of the day I'll just be focusing my mind on blue, blue, blue. Well, let me at least turn on the radio and maybe I can get some blues for entertainment. Yeah, the one Western monk that I know who had good experience with the casinos had been a painter in his lay life. Not a wall painter, but an artist painter. So he was very sensitive by his temperament to colors. So he could work very easily with colored casinos. Okay, so these are the 8 casinos. Then there are 2 other casinos which are added in this list. The 9th is the space casino. And in the old system, it seems the original system, well, let's say the 10th is the consciousness casino. Okay, it seems in the original system of the casinas, as laid out in the suttas, the space casino was equivalent to the base of boundless space. So after one masters the casinas through one of the form objects, like the elements or the colors, then one extends that casino image till it becomes boundless or immeasurable, and then one deflects the attention away from the colored form to the space that is that form is occupying. And when one turns the attention to the space itself, then one enters into the base of boundless space. And that is what they call the space casino. And then when one turns the attention to the consciousness that was pervading boundless space, that becomes the casino of the consciousness casino, which is identical with the base of boundless consciousness. And so in the original system of the 10 casinas, the sutta system, the space casino is identical with the meditation on the base of boundless space, and the consciousness casino is identical with the base of boundless consciousness. Now, what happens in the commentarial system, the system of the Visuddhimagga? The Visuddhimagga explains all of the meditation subjects. And so it has, as all of the meditation subjects for samadhi, and so it has one set called the four formless meditations. And then it gives the explanation of the base of boundless space, the base of boundless consciousness, base of nothingness, base of neither perception nor non-perception. And so to preserve a scheme of 10 casinas, the Visuddhimagga first replaces simply the space casino with what is called the limited space casino. That is, instead of using boundless space, one takes a limited space. This, I guess, would be done with, again, taking a board and cutting a circle in that board, and one directs one's attention not to the colors that might be seen behind that circle, but just to the circle, the empty circle itself, as representing a limited space. And so then one is able to focus upon a limited space, or it could be like, for example, focusing upon the space in a container like this, the space in a flask, the empty space in a cup, any kind of empty space. Of course, one is not getting here so much a mental image. Yeah, one could get a kind of mental impression of space, limited space. And then from that mental image, somehow the counterpart sign arises. I don't know what it's, no idea what it would be like. Okay, so the limited space casino then comes to fill in for the space casino. And for the consciousness casino, the Visuddhimagga system substitutes what is called the light casino. This would be a light that one might obtain. In ancient times, it could be the light. You wouldn't want to use the light of a fire, because then it will become mixed with the fire casino. But one might take the light of the sun or the light of the moon. And one gets the impression of that light until one can visualize a light one could see a light in one's mind's eye, the visual impression. And then when that light becomes something which sort of arises spontaneously by itself and becomes very powerful, very luminous, that becomes the counterpart sign of the light kasina. And one actually finds a basis for the light kasina in the suttas, because there are some passages, I know of these passages in Anguttara Nikaya, which speak about the meditator as developing what is called aloka sanya, the perception of light. And one of the ways it's suggested to do this is to go out into the fresh air at night and look up at the full moon and get the impression of the light of the moon. Here one is not focusing upon the whiteness of the moon as one might for the white kasina, but rather on the brightness or luminosity of the moon. Similarly for the sun, but never stare at the sun for a long time. Perhaps one could even use the flame of a candle if one can focus upon the flame from the aspect of light rather than the aspect of fire. Okay, any questions on the kasinas? Okay, now we'll go into the... We'll just continue and try to finish... We have to finish the suttas. The sutta today. Okay, the next passage is on the four jhanas. We've gone through the jhanas quite a number of times in the past. And this passage is just useful, a little bit different than most of the standard passages on the jhanas, in that it has the similes to illustrate each of the four jhanas. So the first jhana, it's like the a ball of bath powder. This might be what, like shaving soap, the equivalent of what we might use today, where we use a brush over shaving soap to make it puff up into a ball of soap, then sprinkle it gradually with water and knead it till the moisture wets the ball of bath powder, soaks it and pervades it inside and out, yet the ball does not ooze with that water. And so too the monk makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill and pervade this body. So there is no part of the body not pervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Okay, then the second jhana, it's illustrated by the simile of a lake whose waters swelled up from below and no water would be flowing into it from any of the directions, and it would not be replenished by showers of rain. But there would be a cool fount of water welling up in the lake, and that cool water welling up would drench, steep, fill, and pervade the lake, so there would be no part of the lake unpervaded by cool water. And so the monk makes the rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so there is no part of the body not pervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Okay, the third jhana, here rapture falls away and only the sukha, pure pleasure or bliss, remains. So this is illustrated by a pond of blue, red, or white lotuses. Then there would be some lotuses which are born and grow in the water and never rise out of it. And so cool water would drench, steep, fill, and pervade them to their tips and roots. So there is no part of all these lotuses unpervaded by cool water. And so the monk makes the pleasure that's devoid of rapture pervade this body, so there is no part of this whole body unpervaded by that pure pleasure free of rapture. Okay, then comes the fourth jhana, which occurs through the abandoning of pleasure and pain, so that the mind is accompanied by the feeling which is neither pleasant nor painful, then he sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. Then this is illustrated by the simile of a man who is sitting covered from head down with a white cloth, so that the cloth is now covering the head and coming down from the head to the feet. And so there is no part of his whole body not covered by the white cloth. And so in the same way, the monk sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so there is no part of the body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. Notice in the first two similes, the idea is that the pervading factor wells up from inside and then spreads out, covering or extending to the pervaded object from the inside, moving towards the outside. As we come in the simile of the lotus flowers, it's the water, the encompassing water, which covers and pervades the entirety of the lotus, the roots of the lotus flower. And in the fourth simile, it's the white cloth that covers the whole body of the man. Okay, I want to move on so that we can finish the sutta. Okay, so this attainment here, the jhanas, are actually, in my own understanding, these are the subjective states that arise on the basis of the 10 kasinas, particularly the first 8 kasinas, and that arise on the basis of the first 3 liberations. And also the 4 jhanas are another way of representing what are called the 8 bases for transcendence. In other words, we could take any one jhana, and depending upon its strength, purity, and intensity, classify it amongst the 8 bases for transcendence. Okay, now we come to a set of practices. Sometimes they're called the 8 higher knowledges. And the first of these is called insight knowledge. And this is a little bit different from the way we understand insight within the Vipassana tradition, where insight means seeing into the impermanence, suffering, and selfless nature of phenomena. But here, what's called insight knowledge is referring to what we might call the interdependence of consciousness and the body. So the text begins, the Buddha saying, "I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to understand thus. This body of mine, made of material form, consisting of the 4 great elements procreated by mother and father, built up out of boiled rice and porridge, is subject to impermanence, to being worn and rubbed away, to dissolution and disintegration. And this consciousness of mine is supported by it and bound up with it." So here one is distinguishing through, one uses, apparently this insight knowledge arises on the basis of the strong samadhi. And on the basis of that, one distinguishes the body as a material substance and as this material substance as the basis or support for consciousness. And there is a reference to its impermanence here, but this seems to be what I would call a reflective or reflection on impermanence rather than direct insight into the moment by moment arising and passing away of material phenomena. So one reflects that this body is, I think it's anicca dhamma, which means subject to impermanence, subject to passing away. So So I don't get the impression from this description that this passage is actually describing the insight into form as arising and passing away, arising and passing away, you know, through direct perception of the moment-by-moment dissolution of form, but rather as a kind of reflective understanding of that the material body is eventually bound to, well, to dissolve, to disintegrate, and pass away. Okay, then the text uses a simile. Suppose there were a beryl gem of purest water. Is purest water used as a way of describing gems? Anybody have experience with these things? This is Nyanamoli's translation, so I don't know where that kind of language came from. If you have a diamond, do you describe it in terms of a certain quantity of water? Or maybe this is a British way of describing gems. Okay, it's eight faceted. You know, it's been cut with eight faces. It's well cut, clear and limpid, possessed of all good qualities. And through it, there would be a blue, yellow, red, white, or brown thread that has been strung. Then a man with good sight would take it in his hand, and looking at it, he would be able to distinguish the gem itself and the thread which has been strung through it. And so I think in the simile, the jewel represents the body, and the thread going through it represents consciousness. Okay, so even though, you know, the body is always changing, well, the consciousness is always changing too, but there's a certain continuity of the consciousness which seems to be well represented by the simile of the thread. And one can distinguish between the jewel and the thread, and so one can distinguish between the body and consciousness. Okay, the next type of higher knowledge is the knowledge. Here we come into the realm of, we call these superpowers, extraordinary powers. This is called the creating the mind-made body. So here the Buddha says, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to create from this body, this physical body, another body having form. The other body has some appearance, some form, but it's made by mind, and it has all of its limbs complete, so it's like a perfect representation of this body, lacking no faculty. And then this is illustrated by a simile of, by some similes. It's like as if a man were to pull out a reed from its sheath. Even if you go for a walk on the paths here, you see, especially now in late August, you'll see the reeds growing, and then there's a dry sheath which contains it, and you can just pull out the living reed from that dry sheath. So you pull out the reed from its sheath, and then you can distinguish. This is the sheath, this is the reed. The sheath is one thing, the reed is another. But the reed has been pulled out from the sheath. Again, this is illustrated with pulling out a sword from its scabbard in the same way, or to pull a snake out of its slough, of its old dried skin. Occasionally I see some snakes over by the Guanyin statue near the water. If you want to try this out, see how to pull a snake out from its slough. No, I think maybe you better not do that. But as if a person were to do this, then one would say, this is the snake, this is the sloth, the snake is one, the sloth another. And so one could pull out, I guess the meditator goes into a very deep samadhi, and then in that state of samadhi, or coming out to a sort of twilight zone between samadhi and normal consciousness, one can pull out from the physical body a kind of subtle mental body and then send it around to different places, whether things it perceives will be registered by one's own physical body. I don't know that. So please don't ask me embarrassing questions about these higher, not these superpowers. By the way, I think Bhante is still asleep in Taishu Hall. Would you maybe call him up here? I wanted to consult with him. Okay, now we come to the what are called the abhinyas, or the iddhis, I think this is in Chinese, the shantu, correct? Shantong are the powers collectively, but shantu are the iddhipada. Or maybe this would be the shanli. I think shanzu are the four things that are the bases for the powers. Like we had the iddhipada already, but these are the iddhis themselves. Anyway, this isn't the class on Chinese. So this is what it's called in Pali. They're called iddhi. Okay, so what are some of these superpowers? Having been one, you can become many. So the meditator sitting in one place can project many representations of his own body. So he'll appear to be in many places at the same time. And then you can collect all of these many bodies back into one body. One can appear and vanish, you know, so one could be sitting in meditation and suddenly, oops, you can disappear and then people are where have you gone? Why were you here a minute ago? And then after disappearing, everybody should be taking very detailed notes on this. When it appears again. See, there's nothing to it. Don't think it's so hard. Okay, they go unhindered through walls, through enclosures, through mountains, as though through space. You could dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. One could walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. Seated cross-legged, they travel in space like birds. Yeah, seated cross-legged, yeah. So often when I go on a plane flight, and when I get into my seat, if there's not somebody, if the next seat is empty, I cross my legs and then I tell myself, now I'm practicing one of the superpowers. I'm a great yogi. Okay, with their hands they touch and stroke the sun, the moon and sun, so powerful and mighty, and wield mastery with the body as far as the Brahma world. Okay, I'm going to go quickly through the rest so that we finish. You can read the similes on your own. You should have done already. Okay, then comes the divine ear element, which means that one could strengthen one's power of hearing so that one could hear things at a great distance. What is people talking about and across the street, what are they talking about a mile away? You could hear conversations going on in other continents, and also one could extend the hearing to other world systems. So in different realms of existence, so one could hear conversations among the devas or amongst the beings in the realm of ghosts or in the hell realms. All of these one could hear with the divine ear element. Okay, the next one is understanding the minds of others by embracing them, their minds, with one's own mind. So one could understand the state of mind, exactly what their emotions are, what their thoughts are, what kind of mental state they're in. Then comes the recollection of past lives. One could recollect one's many past lives, hundreds of lives, thousands of lives, 100,000 lives. Then with the divine eye, one can see beings passing away and taking a rebirth elsewhere and see how their rebirth occurs in accordance with their karma. Okay, all of these powers that I've been describing so far, superpowers, are still considered lokiya. That means they're still mundane powers. I mean, they're great and wonderful if one attains them, but they're not directly connected to liberation. It seems these powers were known by yogis in the time of the Buddha, so the Buddha included them within his own system of training. And in order for the Buddhists, monks and nuns, to stand out, to be able to surpass the disciples of the other schools, they had to develop these powers themselves, those who were disposed to them. But it's the last superpower, which is supermundane or world transcending. This is the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, the defilements or taints. Okay, so now the Buddha says, again, Udayi, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to realize with here and now and enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. So this is the knowledge that the Buddha has especially emphasized, to know how to bring the taints to an end, to destroy the asavas, the defilements at the root of the cycle of birth and death. So then he gives the simile. It's just as if there were a lake in a mountain recess, clear, pure, undisturbed, and a man with good sight were to see within the pond. He could see shells, gravel, and pebbles, and so on, and distinguish them. And so somebody who has developed this higher knowledge, actually he would be able to know the Four Noble Truths. That is the knowledge that leads to the liberation from the taints. And so by knowing and seeing the Four Noble Truths, he can enter and dwell in the deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. And thereby many disciples of mine have reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge. Okay, so now after that long analysis, long exposition on all of the different practices within his teaching, then the Buddha says, this is the fifth quality because of which my disciples honor, respect, revere, and venerate me and live in dependence on me. And these, Udayi, are the five qualities because of which my disciples honor, respect, revere, and venerate me and live in dependence on me, honoring and respecting me. Okay, and that brings the sutta to an end. Okay. Maybe since it's now almost 11:30, instead of asking for questions, unless there's anything that needs like an immediate clarification, then we'll skip the questions till we'll just bring them up again. We'll have a little discussion period after lunch, say 12:10. We'll come back here for discussion. And then we could discuss any questions.
I
that time. Okay, now next week there won't be a class on Saturday morning because there'll be a weekend meditation retreat here. And again, if anybody wants to attend that retreat, you should speak to somebody in the office about registering for it. This will be a retreat on mindfulness of breathing, Anapanasati. And it will be suitable for beginners. So don't be afraid if you haven't done a retreat before. And then the next class will be the Saturday after that, I think September 8th. And the next class will do interesting change from these very, call this in a vegetarian monastery, meaty, substantive, doctrinal suttas. This will be an interesting sutta to look at. It's called Gatikara Sutta, the sutta about, in fact, we're going to have several suttas coming up which give personal stories. And we could inquire, why are these personal stories included within the Majjhima Nikaya? Because whenever there's a story there, there's always some underlying purpose. The sutta is trying to convey some message, some teaching beneath the veneer or the vehicle or channel of a story, a personal story. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merit with the devas, the buddhas, the dragon spirits, and so forth. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anamodhipa chirang rakantu mang param eta vatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya short way sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya sabbe satanumodantu Sabha Sampate Siddhya Baba Gopadaya Vichetato E Tantare Satakayu Papana Rupiya Rupicha Sanya Sanino Dukha Pamuchantu Pusantu Nibhutin. Okay, so about 12:10, we'll come together again. Okay, we end with three bows to Buddha.